You're listening to Radio Aryan at RadioAryan.com.
Hello and welcome to Truth Will Out Radio. Today's date is the 17th of February 2017 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks. I am also joined today, as always, by the producer of Adolf Hitler, the greatest historian ever told, Mr. Dennis Wise, and also by special guest Messerschmitt, producer of Axis War Heroes. So, Dennis, how are you doing today?
Hi, Sven. I'm doing fine, thanks. Before I forget, I just want to mention a couple of YouTube channels which I feel, you know, a lot of people out there should visit. They do some great work. I know they were inspired with some of my work early on. So one's The Impartial Truth, who does some incredible videos, and also All Modern Cons, who also does some great work. So I just want to give them a quick plug.
Yeah, I've heard of The Impartial Truth. The other one I haven't heard of just yet. And while we're actually giving plugs out, I think we'll just remind people where they can actually find our work. You can find us at www.radioaryan.com. It is important to put the www bit in there. At the moment, we're hoping to get that fixed over the weekend. We're also hoping to get a new site lift over the weekend, so the site should be looking all fresh and new with lots of new interactive facilities with it over the weekend. And you can also find us at Alt-Right Andy's YouTube channel. So if you get over to YouTube, check out Alt-Right Andy's channel. He also has Stormfront Radio on there and Dr. David Duke, lots of other alt-right audio that he has over there on his channel, and he's uploading Radio Aryan content there every day, so you'll get bang up to date content from Radio Aryan over there at Alt-Right Andy's YouTube channel, so do go and check that out. Messerschmitt, how are you doing on this fine, what is it, early spring, late winter's evening? What would you say it is?
I'm doing quite well, thanks. I would say it's late winter, but I have seen some delighting signs of the spring coming, some snowdrops and even some crocuses appearing. So yeah, I'm all set for spring and the growing season.
Yeah, we've got daffodils out here. We know that the sunshine is just around the corner, but it's still a little bit miserable for now. At least we've got Truthful Out Radio to keep people entertained on Friday nights. And I didn't know that we were going to have a presentation from you this week, so we're very pleased to hear that. You contacted me earlier and said that you managed to find another flying ace that we hadn't heard of yet. So perhaps you'd like to get on with the presentation. And remind us again who it is, Heinrich Heinz Barr. Is that the chap we've got for tonight?
Yes, he's called Heinz Barr. And Heinz is basically just a shortened form of Heinrich. His full official name was Oskar Heinz Barr. And his comrades also called him Pritzel or Reste. And his family name means bear, as in grizzly bear. Again, showing how closely related the German and the English languages are. He was born on the 25th of May 1913 in Sommerfeld near Leipzig. His parents were farmers and his father was killed in action in World War I, so he had to grow up without a father. Heinz was notorious for his pranks when he was a boy. For example, when he was 12, he and some mates from school wanted to dig up some turnips on the field of a farmer so that their families might have something to eat, as we are, of course, again, talking about the Weimar period. And they were chased off the field by that farmer. Young Heinz did not think that would do, and so during the night they disassembled a hay wagon of that farmer and with the help of a pulley got the parts onto the roof of the farmer's house and reassembled the wagon there. You can imagine the astonishment of that farmer when he finally spotted the wagon he had been feverishly looking for all over the farm on the roof of his house. The feud with that farmer was not over, however, and one day he would even sick his two dogs on the turnip thieves. A counterstrike seemed necessary, and Heinz, together with his friends, took off one of the wings of a huge barn door, carried it to the village pond, put 2 dozen chickens on that of the farmer, and moved it to the middle of the pond, anchoring it there very firmly. The excited clucking of the chickens and the crowing of the bewildered rooster woke the farmer very early, and once he realized what had happened to his chickens, he tried to recover them using a bathtub, as there was no boat available. The boys had foreseen that, though, and had drilled small holes into it. Inevitably, the farmer soon got very wet, to the delight of the boys, hiding behind some willow bushes. At school, he showed aptitude for anything related to science and technology, but at the same time, he loved everything about the forests and their wildlife. First, he intended to take over the family farm, and after regular school, went to an agricultural school. He also joined the local glider club and became a glider pilot. Then his love for the forest made him change his mind and he planned on becoming a forester. When he saw a Junkers transport plane flying, he changed his mind once more and wanted to become a pilot. He could not afford to become a civilian pilot, however, and so he could not join the Deutsche Lufthansa as he had intended. Instead, he joined the Reichswehr in 1934, working as a mechanic for the 4th Motor Vehicle Battalion, and the following year he was accepted into the Luftwaffe. First, he flew transport planes, having earned a license for flying multi-engined aircraft, but then he transferred to the fighter wing, where he trained on the Bf 109. He was of stocky build, muscular and tough. His appearance and character seemed to be very fitting for his family name. He was by all accounts pleasant to be around and not easily roused to anger, but if someone did become too offensive towards him, he would fight back, verbally at first, which usually did the trick, as he was good with words, quick-witted, and would often leave his opponent speechless after hitting him with some bitingly sarcastic remark, or otherwise, figuratively speaking, of course, hit him over the head. If that was not enough, he was not afraid to use his fists either, if necessary. Soon it turned into a proverb, almost, and became his motto: where the bear hits, grass will grow no more. Many enemies would later learn just how true that was. At the start of the war, Bär was serving with Jagdgeschwader 51, which had been created virtually out of nothing by Theo Osterkamp. We have heard of Osterkamp when we talked about Adolf Galland a few months ago. When he received the order to lead the 51, it existed only on paper. On the 25th of September 1939, Bär was on duty at the border with France, guarding against intruding enemy planes. He was flying in his Bf 109E when he spotted a French Morane. Bär approached it on a frontal collision course, showing nerves of steel. About 200 meters in front of him, the French pilot pulled up his fighter, and Bär fired, scoring several hits on the enemy plane, which started to emit smoke. Not long after that, he was behind the French plane, another burst from his weapons tore up the left wing of the Morane, which then started to descend like a leaf in the wind, uncontrollable. Bär saw no parachute, and the plane impacted on the ground, turning into a ball of fire. "Well done, Bär, that was your first," he heard a comrade calling to him over the radio. Back on the ground, he was first told off because he had left the formation on his own initiative, but then he was also congratulated by the group commander. "At least you got him. Congratulations." On the 29th, he received the Iron Cross Second Class. This early in the war, it was much easier to come by these decorations than in later years. Early in the morning of the 10th of May 1940, the beginning of the actual France campaign, the first group of Jagdgeschwader 51 was attacking the airport of Rotterdam, and Bär was with them. After Dunkirk, Colonel Osterkamp drove to the coast near Wissant to establish an airbase there. But when he returned, a squadron of Spitfires had just attacked. The course had been tracked, however, and Osterkamp ordered all available fighters to counterattack the airfield from which the Spitfires had taken off. They had to be refueling and rearming, he reckoned. Osterkamp's order was in fact to attack the airfield and land if possible at all. Baer was with the attackers, and also Josef Priller, another famous Knight's Cross holder, who was reputed for his excellent eyes, and it was he who spotted the hidden airfield. Priller shot down a Spitfire that hadn't landed yet, and then they strafed the airfield, setting the staff building and several airplanes on fire. 10 Spitfires were burning, and also 4 French Breguet and a Potez. They landed and took several prisoners. The ground personnel had already been evacuated, and the attack on the 51's airbase was supposed to be the last mission before withdrawing to Bordeaux. On the morning of the 13th of June, Baer took part in an attack on the airbases around Paris, escorting Stukas and Heikel 111, but also himself shooting up reconnaissance and fighter aircraft still on the ground. On their way back, they were attacked by a squadron of French fighters who fought with tenacity. They managed to shoot down 8 German bombers and 5 fighters, but lost 22 fighters themselves. Baer was made Schwarmleader, meaning he was in command of a Schwarm, which consisted of 4 fighters. And now the time of the Battle of Britain was at hand. Theo Osterkamp was promoted to Generalmajor, and Werner Mölders was given command of Jagdgeschwader 51. Mölders was the leading German Experte at the time and was the first pilot to receive the Knight's Cross. One day, as he was flying over England with his Schwarm, they were attacked by 9 Spitfires. "Watch out, Pritzel, behind you," he was warned by his wingman. Baer pulled his fighter up into a turn and looked back to see his opponent not able to follow his maneuver. He completed his turn and got into position behind the Spitfire. His machine guns and cannons lit up the Spitfire, and Baer followed it, a mistake which also nearly cost Adolf Galland his life one time, because the other 8 Spitfires were all on his tail. Here's now what happened next in the words of Heinz Baer, as reported later by Baer's first mechanic. Quote, "I saw in the rear view mirror how suddenly the whole bunch of opponents was breathing down my neck. Tracer bullets were whistling by to the left and right of my crate. Then the fuselage was hit. Those darned English were using me as target practice. More bullets hitting the fuselage among terrific noise. The right wing was turned into a sieve, and the left one didn't look much better. Why those darned fellows were shooting up my wings and not the cockpit, I didn't know. I don't know. But one Spitfire after the other tried its luck, and I was weaving this way and that to escape all these salvos." End quote. I'll have to add here that I didn't do justice to the humorous style of Baer. It's really hard to translate to English. Baer was only 2 dozen meters off above the sea, racing eastward, when suddenly a Spitfire appeared on his right flank and opened fire. The glass covering his instrument panel shattered. His engine started to shudder and finally stood still. All he could do was to make the impact as smooth as possible. He was quite successful, and immediately he threw off the canopy and climbed out. His life jacket inflated as he pulled the string. Even though it was summer, the water was ice cold. As he was swimming away from the airplane, he turned around and he saw the tail section still sticking out of the water and then going under. Fortunately, he was spotted by a Heinkel 59, a biplane which can be equipped with floats. Of the just recently established Sea Rescue Command Cherbourg. And in the evening, he was back with his comrades and welcomed with cheers. Baer had to tell the group commander what he experienced, and when he mentioned the cold water, his superior said, "As far as I know, there are 2 currents in the channel, one warm and one cold." "Then I must have fallen into the cold one, Herr Major," he replied laconically. Somewhat later, after he had been shot down two more times over the channel, he commented, "For some reason, I always seem to fall into the cold one." One time over the channel, Bear saw his wingman taking fire from a Spitfire. A big hole was already gaping in his vertical stabilizer, and the Spitfire was about to do more damage as Bear swooped down on him and his bullets hit their mark. The Spitfire was trailing smoke. But as the Spitfire simply flew on a steady course, and no parachute could be seen, Bear approached it, and when he was close enough, he could see the British pilot pointing at his blood-soaked pilot suit and then pointing to his leg, indicating that he was also wounded there. There seemed to be no way that he could parachute from his fighter. Bear signaled to the British pilot that he should turn around and fly east. Fortunately, the engine damage doesn't seem to have been severe, as the smoke soon subsided, and Bear and his wingmen guided the Spitfire to Calais, where it landed safely. Over the radio, they had already called for an ambulance. The British pilot, who turned out to be a captain, shook Bear's hand, and Bear then had his first mechanic bring a bottle of cognac, which he gave to the captain to help ease his recovery. After the 6th Air victory, Bear received the Iron Cross First Class on the 6th of July 1940. And now let's hear what Werner Möllers had to say about Bear. Quote, "This young pilot has something which can make him into one of the best. He is a fighter, a daredevil, without selling his skin too cheaply. He has the eye and the flying abilities required for a true fighter pilot." End quote. And this is what Bear in later years had to say about Mulders, who was called Fati or Daddy by the pilots because as their superior, he always had an open ear for them. Quote, "He was a fellow you could touch, a role model concerning education and bravery. He did not only become my revered mentor. Everybody was striving to be like him. That is what he was about, caring for us like a father would and passing on to us all that we still needed to learn to become good fighter pilots like him." And on these bright notes, I will end part one. Next week, we are going to find out that he did not only serve in France and during the Battle of Britain, but was fighting on more or less all the fronts of the war.
Well, thanks, Schmidt. That was, really enlightening. I mean, they're really, really honourable people, aren't they? These people that were fighting in the war, you think he went there to help the British, to help to rescue that British fighter pilot and then shared cognac with him? You know, that's not the sort of behaviour that you see happening nowadays, but back then they were really honourable. And I think you can see that from the innocent pranks that he was playing when he was a boy. And you think of all the thought that went into playing these jokes on the farmer after they'd been stealing the turnips from him, you know, rebuilding something on the roof of the shed and, you know, thinking ahead to drill holes in the bath so that when the farmer went back out on the pond to rescue his chickens, you know, the bath sank underneath him. And that shows really forward thinking and ingenuity and, you know, sort of something quite funny, like playing a joke. You just wouldn't really see that nowadays with young people today. They wouldn't play a joke like that, and the farmers wouldn't expect to have a joke like that played on them. But when you've got a community, when you've got people that are all the same race, the same nation, the same language, with the same sense of humour, then you can do things like that. And it's that's a really interesting tale there. I look forward to hearing more. I know that he's reckoned as one of the best flying aces. He's certainly in the top 10 with quite an incredible number of downed aeroplanes from the enemy. And also, you know, you've got a mention there of Galland, who you've also done one of your Axis War Heroes presentations on. So it just shows you how they're all linked up together and all fighting in the same war. It's I enjoyed that. Dennis, have you got any comments you'd like to make on that?
Well, I'm a chicken when it comes to flying, you know that. when he says that he's skimming over the sea with a Spitfire coming closing in on him, it's the last place on earth I'd want to be. It really will. I mean, I can't admire these guys any more than I do. Tremendous courage and, as you say, honour, and tremendous ability as well. You know, and just incredible courage.
I'm not sure, you know, it also makes me think that it must have been much cheaper to learn to fly back then, because you've got a farmer there that was getting gliding lessons and learning to fly a glider. And I'm not sure, you know, whether someone of the status of a farmer or someone who worked on a farm would be able to afford to do anything like that nowadays. Must have been cheaper back then, I would have thought.
Well, I think it was sponsored by the National Socialist Government, these glider clubs. So it wasn't they didn't have to pay as much as would have been necessary if they had to pay the market price, so to speak.
So because he'd already shown talent and aptitude at doing that, they were prepared to help fund the cost, that sort of thing.
Yes, that is my understanding.
Yeah, sorry, Dennis, you were saying something then. I think we might have talked over you.
Yeah, what I was saying was... I mean, they still had the pilots from World War One, obviously, but I mean, they were banned from having an air force at all, weren't they, during the Weimar? So there wouldn't have been that many up and coming pilots, I mean, I thought. So it would have been interesting for the National Socialists to actually fund and cut price to get some pilots up to speed, I would imagine.
Well, it was a glider as well that they were using rather than an aeroplane. Anyway, did you want to say any more about that, or did you want to go on to talking about the brown shirts and the fighting with the communists and Adolf Hitler's early life, which was the other subject that we were going to cover tonight?
Yeah, well, that's the part I'd like to take a look at, because of the propaganda against Adolf Hitler coming from all directions, really, in his early years. And he's obviously the myths and the rumours of him being sponsored by bankers and Rothschilds, etc. So, yeah, it's an area that's pretty interesting to myself and hopefully to other people as well, right?
Yeah, I'm sure we'd like to hear it.
Yeah, well, I believe that the brown shirts actually were surplus uniforms from what the soldiers would have wore if Germany had won World War I, you know, in the colonies, believe it or not. So they had a surplus of them. Which you know, people could purchase quite cheaply, apparently. And people were not really up to speed on National Socialism in them days. I've usually been fed propaganda these guys going around beating everybody up to ensure that Hitler eventually got into power, where once you take a look into it, actually, to have been a National Socialist in that early part from the 1920s onwards was probably one of the most dangerous occupations that you could be in, because of the communists who actually looked quite not only were the thousands of people being beaten up, but there were quite a number of murders as well. There's some figures here from, say, 1923. There were 21 murders that year, and in 1933, well, from that time on, the 10 years, that decade, there was 200 in total murdered. In 1932, the year before he came to power, there was 84 murders, and one of the most famous ones, of course, was Horst Wessel, who simply answered his door and was shot in the head. Obviously, they've been targeted where they lived. There was quite a number either stabbed or shot. So it was a pretty hazardous occupation. But the reason he needed them was because the communists obviously would storm the actual meetings and the speeches that Hitler gave. So he did need some protection. And we came across one today, actually, where it's quite legendary in Munich, where 800 communists attacked the place, and 50 of the National Socialist brown shirts actually fought them off, and it went down in National Social legendary history. So But like I said, it was pretty horrendous. And all these people who say that the bankers funded him and the Rothschilds, et cetera. Once you know the details of the dangers that Hitler himself had, some assassination attempts, and no different, of course, to what Putin's facing today as well. I mean, one instance where he left after a speech, he left earlier than expected and the bomb went off, killed a number of people. And he always believed that it was the British who was involved in that particular incident. But there was, I read somewhere once, there was like 40 attempts on his life, which, you know, just to show like that he always felt that it came from Providence, and I believe that he had a goal in life, and that was to save Germany from the Versailles Treaty implemented by the Jews. So quite a formidable job that he gave himself, and managed to get to power in 1933, despite all the violence and the attacks.
Well, I think he was, you know, quite an amazing talent as a speaker, which I don't think he really discovered until he'd actually joined the National Socialist German Workers' Party. I don't think there are that many people in the party itself. I think he joined them because he'd been asked to gather some intelligence on them, or just find out information about them for the military. And I think once he joined, he discovered that this was, you know, this was the truth, and that this is what he should be involved in. And I think then he gave a speech and really discovered that he had this ability to hold the attention of a crowd and get their emotions going, and get them to believe in him. And it pretty quickly, I think, before he was talking to like 2,000 people at a time, and more people at a time, and because he had this magnetic personality. I mean, you can look at the pictures of him speaking, can't you? And the audiences are hanging on every word. You know, he's got this thing about him that commands your attention, and it was that which brought the masses to him. It wasn't bankers giving him money so that he could mount a huge election campaign like we see today happening in like we've just seen in America. It was nothing like that. It was his charisma and the way that he spoke to the people that brought them around to him. I mean, it is similar to Donald Trump, because he did that tour speaking to all those people. That's what got him to where to become president. It wasn't a big advertising campaign. He was against a big advertising campaign by the bankers. It was similar with Hitler. It was his personality, and it was the points that the National Socialists were arguing for. That's what brought the people to them. And that 25-point plan that the National Socialists had, it addressed every problem that the Weimar Republic had, and at the same time it also addressed all the problems that we have always had by adhering to natural law and saying that the interests of the group have got to be more important than the individual. You cannot just have an individual on his own, that he has to rely on the group for everything else, and if you do what you can, everything you can for the group, then that's going to raise up the individual anyway, because he's a member of that group. Getting rid of usury, making Christianity and the morals of Christianity the center of the state. All of these things were things that, you know, need to be done by a white nation if it's to secure its existence and secure the prosperity of its citizens. So, you know, you had the perfect man there to explain all that to the people, because he had this charisma. You know, he had this natural attraction to him that the people could see, and that's why they went to his meetings. And this is why the communists were so terrified of him. And again, they were doing exactly the same as they're doing today, and they used violence to try and shut these meetings down. They wouldn't debate. They would just turn up there mob-handed and attack them. They would smuggle themselves into the meeting, and then they would start fighting in there, throwing chairs, throwing beer bottles. You know, people were seriously injured by them. Just mindless violence to try and shut down the politics of this man. And because he was so successful, and because they knew that the bankers knew and the Jews knew that if he managed to get the people's ear, that they would all support him. Why would you not support somebody who wants to make your country the best that it's been, your nation the best that it's been? Do make sure that the state and the establishment does everything to make your country better again. I mean, who wouldn't want to go along with that? And this is what I hear today. I mean, people try and knock Donald Trump, but who would knock somebody? Who would knock an American that wants to make America great again? And this was the same with Hitler. You know, he was a German that wanted to make Germany great again. He wanted to make the German people great again. He wanted to reverse all the insults of the Versailles Treaty. And he wanted his people to be prosperous and healthy. He didn't wish harm on any of the other European nations. Far from it. You know, if the other European nations had followed his example and set up National Socialism with a different type for whichever European country it was in, then Europe would have been far better off than it is today when we look at it today. And because of these attacks that they had, this is why they had to form the Brown Shirts, wasn't it, Dennis? Because sometimes, you know, people say, oh, he formed this paramilitary to, you know, just to attack the communists. He was forming this army before he even got into power. But, you know, this was a civil group that was there to protect the meetings more than anything else. Do you want to talk a bit more about these Brown Shirts? Yeah.
Well, it always amuses me because one part in the documentary, Adolf Hitler, a bit of story, I left out. I didn't leave it out for any other reason than I thought it had been covered anyway. But I got early criticism of leaving it out by these people who didn't agree with it. And they said that I never covered the SA leadership being taken out. It always amused me when people who obviously didn't like Adolf Hitler suddenly took an interest in infighting in the National Socialist Party. But, I mean, it got to a point where there was, I mean, something like 3 million of the SA, and Ernst Röhm, one of the leaders, was getting quite powerful. And when you think the German army was only 100,000 at that time, that's a pretty formidable civilian type of army. So Hitler felt that, and others in the party felt that it was getting too powerful and getting a little bit too big for his ambitions. And so they had the infighting, and the leadership was taken out. But I mean, this goes on throughout history, where, you know, if you're going to that old saying, you know, power is not given to you. You know, real power you take, and that's been the case all throughout history, and this was no different. Adolf Hitler had to show that mettle and that ruthless streak, because without it, you know, he just wouldn't have gone anywhere. So, you know, like I said, eventually he disbanded the SA, and, you know, then he brought in the SS. But it's, you know, still it was needed at that time, because people are not really informed of the difficulty that the threat of communism that Germany had and still had, even up to 1933. And then just on, 36, you know, Hitler was in Spain helping the Spanish fight communism. So consequently, it was a threat all over Europe. So it was just, like you said, he was charismatic, and his speaking was obviously a huge strength. And his educating of the nation was also crucial as well. People began to understand that these parties, like the Social Democrats, were communists in cheap clothing, if you like. I mean, there was a piece in, I can remember, in Mein Kampf once, when he actually criticised over the losing the guns, and he criticised the left and the Weimar Republic for handing them over, taking them off people. But he also said that he criticised the people on the right. He didn't consider himself left or right. He considered himself centre ground, which is what I've always thought about nationalism anyway. And so, you know, this is somebody who's, as you say, loves his country, and he's trying to keep these communists at bay. And when you look at it, the overall after World War II, he probably saved Europe from Stalin and communism anyway. So, we should be a bit more grateful to the guy for that, for sure. But, definitely, it wasn't an easy time. And the path to power for him was such a ruthless and dangerous path. For people to say, oh, it's easy with the bankers funded him and Rothschilds, and he was a Rothschild agent, it's just pretty ludicrous, to be honest.
Yeah, it's it's a charge you often see. It comes from the people that tend to follow the conspiracy theories. Another one that they will bring up is the fact that we have the European Union now, and they think that Hitler's plans was for something similar, that it yeah. was going to be a European Union, we'd all be one, there'd be no borders, and it would be like a new world order, supranational government like we have now. But we know that that wasn't the case. He did want to unite the European countries, but as separate sovereign nations that work together for the good of Europe and for the good of Europeans and for the wider white world as well. I mean, don't forget that he had a lot of support in America. Before the war started, there were national socialist groups that were forming in America and elsewhere. I mean, did you know if there ever was any in Australia or New Zealand at all? I know we had them in America. Have you ever looked into that at all, Dennis?
I have heard of. I think so. Yeah, but it doesn't spring to mind. But it does ring a bell. Yeah, I mean, certainly England did as well, didn't it? They had the Mosley's fascists, which were based on the same thing.
Well, yeah, and in Holland as well, they had quite a strong national socialist movement in Holland before the war actually broke out. There were Dutch that were going over to Germany, joining the Hitler Youth, and there were national socialist organizations in Holland. And then when Germany had to occupy Holland because it had to secure borders and prevent Britain from getting in there, they already had the structure there and the people there that they could count on to make sure that things ran smoothly. It was like when they went in and liberated the Baltic countries from the Soviets. For quite some time, they'd actually been helping out the partisans by giving them weapons, so that they knew that the Germans were going to come in and liberate them. And the Latvians and the Lithuanians and the Estonians helped the Germans so that they could get rid of the Soviets. So, there was this nationalist feeling throughout Europe that we needed to help Germany rather than helping the communists. And if Germany occupied a country, it wasn't so that they could rule over them, as we're told by Hollywood today. It wasn't because Hitler wanted a great big world empire. It was just because he wanted to secure Germany from Britain and the Allies and secure Europe from the communists.
From the bankers, yeah.
Yeah, if it wasn't for Hitler, we would have all been, Bolshevized. The Soviets would have made their way into Western Europe if Hitler hadn't protected us. If all those brave European people hadn't laid down their lives voluntarily to go and fight against them, you think there are people from Britain, France, Austria, Holland, all over Europe, there were people that were voluntarily fighting in these Waffen-SS units against the Soviets. And just the story of the SS is inspiring, isn't it, really? When you think of SA, and then they started forming the SS, and other people wanted to join the SS. So first off, they had the German nations or Germanic nations that could join the SS, and eventually it was all European nations could have their own SS and take part in this battle against godless communism. These brave men, they were the they were the best of the very best. They were taught to not just be incredibly fit physically, but also to be of very high morals and politeness
and intelligent
etiquette and the way to treat people. It wasn't just about being the best physically. It was about being the best in absolutely everything. And if you've got somebody that is best in absolutely everything, then, you know, the chances are if they have children with somebody who is the best at absolutely everything, then they're going to have very bright children and they're going to be of great benefit to the nation. This is the thinking behind all this supposed, oh, this breeding program of the Aryan race. It's just common sense, really, isn't it?
Well, the problem was Hitler knew, obviously, that Europe, you know, the birth rate was down just like it is today. And, you know, when people say he was a Rothschild, for instance, I mean, as soon as he got into power, as soon as he didn't hesitate, he got rid of the communists and the Jews, all from positions of power and bankers, without hesitation, which caused then international Jewry to have a meeting, because obviously they've now lost a source of income from a country in Europe, which they don't actually want it to spread. And then they have the meeting and they come back and they say to the Germans, get rid of Hitler and reinstate everybody else. The answer obviously came back, no. Who are you to tell us what to do? And then consequently, you know, this blockade, this war, sanctions war, which is putting sanctions on any country is an act of war, was put onto you, onto Germany to starve them. So, you know, I mean, this isn't the actions of a Rothschild agent. And like I said, then, you know, he gave financial, help to the German mothers to have more children, 1,000 marks for 4 children, you know, which caused the increase of that birth rate. Then this is even before the war started, the actual fighting war started, when he went into Austria, he cleared out everybody again, put Rothschilds under, one of the Rothschilds under arrest, put him in prison, and would only release him after he got a world record, somewhat still stands today, for someone paying a ransom. So again, this isn't the actions of anyone but a true nationalist and a leader that loved his country. And he obviously took the fortunes as well off the Rothschilds. Once war did break out, they all scampered out to Europe. And when, especially when France fell, there was another wife of a Rothschild was placed in a camp, and she died later on in the war from. Well, it says in Wikipedia that she died from being gassed, but this was after her husband changed his mind after he originally said that she died from disease, which many did do at that time. So this is. Goes against all these myths, etc. And to be quite honest, the demonization that he's had relentlessly for the last 70 years shows the hatred that they do have for him. And like I wrote in a comment recently, you know, I can find more statues of Satan in the world today than I can of Adolf Hitler.
Yeah, I think non-white countries don't really understand it, do they? You know, places like India, Japan, Thailand, they just see that this was a formidable enemy in the Second World War. Just the head of the leader of the country that lost. That was all. They don't attach anything else to it. So you have, you know, National Socialist themed restaurants, Hitler ice cream, all these sorts of things. They don't understand why it is that the West gets all upset about this. And it's all just due to this Hollywood programming that we've had. And if the conspiracy theorists were to actually look into Adolf Hitler, they would see that he's the guy that they've been looking for. He's the person that they thought didn't exist. You know, it must get very depressing for them, thinking that both sides are always controlled and that nobody's ever thrown off the shackles of usury and everybody's always been under the thumb of these bankers. Because it is a really inspiring story when you hear about it, and once you learn that, you can see the same thing happening today. I mean, just to take it back to these attacks that went on when they first started the National Socialist meetings and he first started his speeches, he had all these communists that were attacking him that tried to shut them down, and when that failed, when he actually got into power, then you had the countries all around moving in to attack him and making war against him. So you can see that these Jewish bankers, they started off with just the man on the street fighting against him. And when that didn't succeed, they moved to manipulating all the other countries in Europe to go to war against him. And you see the same thing happening now. You see Donald Trump, they tried to stop all of his meetings, all of his speeches. They failed at that. Now that he's actually in office, there you've got George Soros that is funding all these organizations to riot and start insurrection over there in the United States and just trying to stop everything that he does. And again, they're going to fail. But this time, they're not going to be able to rally all the other countries to go to war against America, because America is the most powerful country in the world. Now, I can really see parallels between what's happening now and what was happening back then. And we're in a very different world now. And it's a very different country that now has a nationalist leader. He is a nationalist leader. He may not be an ethno-nationalist, but he is a civic nationalist. You know, we know he's not Hitler. He's not speaking up for the white race, but he is speaking up for America. And whether you're white or black in America, you're still, you know, being taken advantage of by the Jews. So the fact that he stands up and speaks about the lies that are in the media and the way that these special interests, these banking interests, are controlling things, it's very similar to what Hitler was talking about back there in his day. All it was that Hitler was more refined and more accurate in what he was saying. He was able to actually name the ethnicity that was doing this, whereas Donald Trump can just name these special interests or globalists or these other terms that we know all actually refer to Jews. They're just more politically correct terms. It's very interesting times that we live in, Dennis. I think what we need is to have our own brown shirts, the equivalent of brown shirts. That's what they're going to need over there in America. I see that could be coming at some point. There could be these civil protection groups. I just heard in his speech today a wonderful piece of news from Trump. He's setting up a new department in America, Department of in Homeland Security, specifically to look after the victims of immigrant crime. So that's pretty much the victims of black on white crime from illegal immigrants, an entire department to look after them. And I never thought I would hear of anything like that going on in our countries. I mean, that's just too good to even be true, to hear something like that. So we could very well see these civilian groups, civilian militias, particularly to protect right-wing people when they want to go and speak. I mean, you look at what happened with Milo when he gave his speech at Berkeley, when they set fire to the place. Look at what happened with Gavin McGuinness when he tried to give a speech. Look at Richard Spencer, who's been thumped a couple of times just for walking out there on the streets. And these are people that are not as radical as we are. And as we were always saying, Dennis, as you said in this you know, in this program, we actually hold the center ground. You know, we actually promote what's natural law. And we need protecting from these people if we go out and speak. And now they've got this movement in America with this patriotic movement. You know, they're going to have to do something to protect themselves against these leftists. That is the only option.
The left have always had that violent streak, as we know. But they've been always portrayed as, you know, the ones that are actually picked on, which isn't true. I mean, I can't see the daylight when Trump will turn around and get rid of the Fed as Hitler did in Germany. But I think if he ever did, then that's when, the country would really start to pick up, just as Germany did, because once you start giving away, you know, 30 billion over the next few years to Israel, you know, America's not in a position to do that. But, you know, like you said, times are different at the moment. But certainly, Hitler is the type of person, he had the personality, he had the drive, he had the talent, he had numerous things going for him, you know, the charisma on top, which, somebody who was more or less single-handedly brought that Rothschild grip on Europe. Is the reason why they hate him, and these people just can't understand it. I mean, you get these people who understand that the bankers and the New World Order, that, you know, they realize that they're the problem, and yet they see Hitler as a problem as well, when he was actually fighting them. This is what they can't, you know, they can't see.
Well, I've just got someone saying there in the chat room, Hitler wasn't surrounded by Jews. Well, you know, we know there are these differences. We're not saying that Donald Trump is Hitler. We're just pointing out some of these similarities that we can see going on. I just, when you look at the National Socialist 25-point plan, I think you can apply that to today. I was looking at the National Socialist Movement, the American National Socialist Movement, looking at their site the other day, and they've got the same 25-point plan there, but they've modernized it slightly. But it's still the same thing. You know, we need territory for white people. We need, you know, we need areas which are ethnically homogenous. We need citizens should only be part of the nation, part of the ethnic nation. We can have guests. People can come to the country as guests, but they should not have a say in the making of any of our laws. That should be strictly for the nation whose country it is, whose government it is. And the government should just be there to look out for the needs of one specific ethnic nation. And the government, the people that make up the government, should be made up from that specific ethnic nation, and only the people from that nation should be voting on anything that happens. I mean, that really is just common sense. Why would you allow in anyone from another people group to start telling you what your laws should be, or having any say in what you're doing, or even owning anything that's a part of the country, a part of the infrastructure? Like everything that's in Britain should be all the infrastructure, all the power stations, all the railroads, the telecommunications, all of that should be owned by the British people. It was the British people that built it. So why isn't it owned by the British people? Why is it owned by foreign companies so that they can, you know, twist us and make money out of things like heating that we need, water that we need? How come that's been turned into a profit-making venture for foreigners, when we're the ones that built it all?
Well, I think people like Thatcher and Obama and people like that, who were obviously worked for the Rothschilds, is to sell off these assets, and the companies of the Rothschilds actually buy them up for a lot cheaper than to be expected, and they get more powerful, and we as a nation go more multicultural. You know, the aim I think is to actually eventually become Muslim, but run by Jews, and no difference in America. I mean, I saw a video the other day on a place, Deerport in Michigan. It just looked like Baghdad, and not an American flag in sight. I think Obama in particular did more damage than what people think, because I think a lot more Muslims were brought into America than he led on. Same in Germany. I think Germany now is a country that's gone. Not only is it being overpowered with this immigration, but actual Germans themselves don't realise what's happening to them, because they've been so brainwashed over the years. So it's a difficult time for them countries in particular. But yeah, for sure, Trump at least has put what I would say is he's plugging up the hole at the moment, and then he's going to reinforce it with walls as well.
With the Muslim problem, the Islam problem, do you think that's a side effect of bringing in as many people as they possibly can into the white countries, because there's just so many Muslims out there? A large portion of Africa and Middle East is Muslim. We know the Jews want to bring them all here and blend us out, so we have no loyalty to our nation. Do you think the fact that a large portion of them are Muslims and they're trying to bring in their Sharia law, do you think that's a side effect of it, or do you think that's part of what they always intended?
No, I think it's perhaps what they always intended. I think to get rid of Christianity, to bring in, say, for Ireland, for instance, once over Ireland would have big families, and over the years, you know, they've had certain, people can now have sex with condoms and things like that, which prevents the big families. But the Muslims come over to Ireland. The Somalians are still having, you know, families of kids of 10 and 11. So, you know, just by the sheer weight of numbers, the fact that they can have so many wives, if you can depopulate the Christian population as they've done with abortions and everything else, etc., and then you bring a host of Muslims in with 3 to 4 wives and umpteen children, then it isn't going to take that long for that Christian population to be the minority.
I suppose
I think it was intended.
If they're also saying, this other religion, this is an equivalent, you know, you have Abrahamic faith, this is an equivalent. It's just the same as Christianity. That obviously is going to weaken Christianity and weaken the Christian foundation of the country as well, isn't it? Which is what it's done, which obviously is going to benefit the Jews. To have the Muslims here, they've always worked hand in hand with Muslims. I mean, whenever they've been kicked out of European countries, that's where they've gone, and they've always been the ones that brought the Muslims in, like they did in Spain and in Italy. And the Jews do very well in countries that are being run by Muslims. You know, they held all the really high positions, in Moorish Spain. They were the ones that were running the establishment, the same as they are now, and the Christians were the slaves. You know, Muslims and Jews have always got on very well. They say that Muhammad's mother was actually a Jew, and he was taught by these rabbis, and you know, that's where a lot of the inspiration for the Quran came from. They have this brotherly link, don't they?
Yeah, well, you've got to look at the Muslim countries that are in league with Israel, because neither Israel nor Saudi Arabia or the other countries took any of these brother Arabs, but instead directed them directly to Europe. There's another reason why I think it's all been intended.
Yeah, the Palestine-Israel thing, I mean, that's the only problem they have, and that's just two countries. Everywhere else, you know, they get on fine. They work well together. And as you say, these Arab countries, they won't take in any refugees. They won't take in anyone from Syria.
Exactly.
They've offered to build mosques to accommodate them in Europe.
Yeah, they're getting them over here anyway.
Nice of them, isn't it? They fund all these mosques. You know, the Saudis put up the money for them, and then the British government adds loads to it in community grants. So we pay for them, and the Saudis pay for them, for people to be indoctrinated in how much they hate white people, and how in 100 years the whole place is going to be Muslim. I mean, you showed me that video earlier, Dennis, the Britain First video. It's supposedly an honest Muslim, and in it the Muslim is saying, yes, all of us Muslims, we live in hope of the day when the whole country becomes Islamic, and we're told that that is what's going to happen in our Quran. Yeah. So we do all we can to make that happen. And yes, you know, we wouldn't want that to be done to us, but tough, basically.
Exactly.
Quite honest. Exactly. Speaking candidly, I mean, that is what's going to happen if we don't stand up and put a stop to it and speak out against it. I mean, this is, you know, one of the good things about Trump is that he is calling it Islamic terrorism, and he is shining a spotlight on what the Muslims are doing. We would like him to shine a spotlight on the Jews as well, but you know, 1 out of 2 isn't bad when nobody was shining a spotlight on them before.
Well, the problem is this is why they wanted him banned, because you know they're saying what he's saying is hate speech, when he's actually pointed it out, as you say, the problem. And if we were to point it out publicly, we would be getting a hate speech summons on us. So. You've got to be thankful that he's around for that at least.
Yeah, well, that's why we point it out here on Truth About Radio every Friday, same time, every week, same time, same place. Dennis, thank you very much for coming on once again. Thank you, Messerschmitt, for your presentation. We've had to actually drop the call with him, but hopefully you're back next week with part 2. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We'll be back next week, same time, same place at Radio Aryan. Have a wonderful weekend.
Yeah. too.